for power in a coup.
Blog Talk Radio.
Started to impose their language and culture on Arabs of the empire.
Thank you.
family. One love, one love. I hope everybody's doing well out there. I was trying to get some things together in my notes. But welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. We're going to try to unpack several things tonight. A lot going on in the world. I know you all know it. But, you know, if we can't make sense of it, then we don't need to be trying to pick sides and choose sides and talk about who's doing what to who and da-da-da-da. Okay, because this is a very long-standing conflict. It's been going on for, actually, I want to say almost, could be about 100 years at this point. But anyway, yeah, it's about 100 years. In any event, let me finish this up real quick. One second. Mother was doing a lot of things today, and you know, when I have to get ready to edit this show, it definitely takes a lot of time. So I just wanted to get some more information and gather some more data to give to you with regards to different conflicts that are happening right now in the world. You might enjoy it. Hopefully you're going to enjoy it because I got a lot I want to share. One more moment. I'm here. I'm here. Okay, hopefully you are going to enjoy tonight's show. As I always try to convey to you guys, like, seriously, you know, if you need to get a pen and some paper or a notebook or open up notes in your phone, you want to take notes, that is perfectly fine because I'll be unpacking a lot, all right? So just stay with me. I have to get my glasses. Give me a moment. I'm going to get my glasses. First of all, yay. Okay. I have my protective glasses because I don't like looking at the computer screen for too long. Welcome, welcome to the Black Alice in Wonderland radio show, episode number 127. Hey! Okay. My husband, my tech man.
I'm a little too loud.
Thank you, sweetheart. Can I bring myself over to it?
That helps too.
You know. Oh, I know what to do. Hold on for me. I know what to do. I gotta put it there. Because that way I'm blocking one of the little speaker things.
Thanks,
you know. Pitch control. You're helping me out. He's my tech man. All right. Let me just get this in this cradle. Come on now. That's right. One of them days. It's one of them days today, family. Minute I'm going to do something.
Put it. Okay.
Let's see. Birthday, if we can. This is a little bit better. And feel free to text me, those of you who have my number and you're on tonight. Let me know if you can hear me nice and clearly. I appreciate that. Let me check myself. 1, 2, 1, 2. All right. Seems pretty decent to me. Okay, here we go. So, again. Welcome, welcome, welcome to Black Alice in Wonderland Radio Show. This is episode 127. I am your hostess with the mostest, Queen Amina. Is that better? Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. And I want to say happy birthday to all the Scorpios. It's Scorpio season. Happy birthday to all the Scorpios. First up, my wonderful, beautiful niece, Maya. She turned 21 yesterday. I'm like, go on, baby, now you're legal. I know you're sipping on something someplace. Happy birthday to you, my love. I wish you all the best always. Also to my beautiful sisters that I went to college with. We were roommates in the same dorm. And they were also in my wedding. Amazing, beautiful women. Crystal Fitzwalker and Danella Brown. I love y'all. Thank you. Happy birthday. Also to one of the baddest drummers, Mr. Chris Daddy Dave. It is your birthday. Happy birthday. I know we are coming. A lot of these birthdays are going to happen in November. But, you know, Scorpio season has kicked off. And so I want to say happy birthday again to all the Scorpios. Don't sting too many people, okay? Because, you know, I'm Scorpio. They'll sting you in a minute, honey. But happy birthday. One love, one love. And, you know, family, I know that we are aware of the fact that today is October 30th, 2023. Tomorrow is Halloween. And here we go. You know, it's always been an interesting celebration. I put interesting in parentheses because I do not really celebrate Halloween. Of course, I used to when I was younger before I actually gained the truth about what it was. But I don't celebrate it anymore. So don't come ringing my bell for no candy because we don't do that up in this household. I think you all... You know, I know y'all go hard with me, and I appreciate it. And I'm going to, you know, divulge some information because I know we get caught up in certain mores and folkways and traditions and what have you that exist in this country. But it doesn't mean that everything that you're celebrating is actually good. And Halloween is one of the worst, quote-unquote, holidays / celebrations. Halloween is actually a major satanic holiday. It would definitely behoove you to understand that many of our quote-unquote holidays coincide with the satanic church and satanic celebrations. So, and satanic celebrations are definitely not about giving candy out and dressing up all cute and stuff like that. It's the total opposite. They actually do commit human sacrifices on this day, and they do a lot of bloodletting in order to try to increase their power. So this is something that a lot of people are grossly unaware of. You know, it seems like it's just, you know, a little bit of folly and frolic. Let's have some fun. But in actuality, it's really not pleasant, okay? The roots of Halloween are not sweet. And it has been practiced from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So it was formerly known as All Hallows Eve, okay? Meaning that the merriment was supposed to happen at night in the dark, all right? And it was also created so that the dead and negative spirits could actually walk upon the earth, and they would be able to blend in with the merrymakers dressed in costumes, you know, going to parties or going door-to-door to get candy and what have you. Halloween is always, always directly followed by All Saints Day. Those of you who are Christian, especially if you are Catholic or even Episcopalian, All Saints Day is the day that you are to celebrate, you know, the saints. But right before All Saints Day is Halloween, and they are put together in the calendar in that way so that, as I said before, the dead and the negative spirits or even the satanic energies would have to be sort of like, quote, unquote, back in the box by All Saints Day. Now, All Saints Day is November 1st, okay? So immediately follows Halloween, and that is for specific and succinct reasons. All Hallows Eve, as I said, was a satanic and pagan holiday. We do have nice, pretty pagan holidays, but this is not one of them. And it also has a little bit of roots in a bit of like almost like racism to a certain extent. You're probably going to be like, what do you mean? Well, the original inhabitants of Great Britain were actually melanin-dominant, quote-unquote, black people, okay? There's significant evidence of this. There have been tombs that have been found of Black royalty. Even Scotland and Nova Scotia were named after Queen Scotia, who was a Black queen. It's very, very deep. Now, what I'm about to tell you is not very common in a lot of modern history books. You need to get books that are written from maybe a little over 100 years ago for you to be able to glean some of this information, because the internet isn't really going to tell you that. We know the internet is controlled. We know Google is controlled. And this is why I always talk about making sure you have books, because when you start to look at how things are put together and why things are the way they are, what exists the way it exists, different traditions and different things, you might want to, you might pull back from some of them, especially this one. So during the, I want to say around maybe 500 or so, 500-600 in there somewhere, and then of course later. But at that time, you had Black folk living in these regions. You have the Black Saxons of Germany. You have Black royalty all throughout Europe. And so don't get the idea that Europe was just all white, because it wasn't. Now, the most northern parts, even the most northern parts were affected by African people. Again, we migrated from out of Africa to go all over this planet. It really bothers me, whether we're talking about Pangaea when everything is all together, or different periods when stuff starts to break apart, please realize that human beings, especially melanin-dominant human beings, have been on this planet for over 350,000 years. And I'm talking about Homo sapiens. So what you see a lot of times, especially antiquity in Africa and North Africa, where Egypt is located, where Palestine is located, the original inhabitants of these regions were a very dark-skinned people. Nonetheless, back to Great Britain, you get the invasion of the white Angles and Saxons and Jutes, J-U-T-E-S. And they came in to take over the entire region. They were very, very brutal. Again, if you read the book Iceman Inheritance, you will get an idea, and that's by Michael Bradley, you will get an idea of what it was like in an ice age or even age life, okay, what it was like. And I always talked about this when I would do my lectures and talking about the differences between the white-skinned European and the melanin-dominant African, Indian, Asian, you know, because we are the world. We were everywhere. We civilized every planet, and excuse me, every part of this planet. So when you have these white Angles, which becomes Anglo-Saxon later, and which becomes like WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, they came into the region and they desecrated the region, killing most of the population off, et cetera, et cetera. But later on, according to Quora and some of my own literature, the Vikings, the white Vikings, and the white Vikings also usurped the original Black Viking, because the original Black Viking is actually a Twa person, and the Twa people come from Africa. So the wearing of the helmet with the horns comes from Africa, because the horns are representative of Herheru, who is the goddess who is associated with the cow. She's also associated with sacred femininity. So the Twa people are your original Viking people. They shaved their teeth and what have you. And so the white Vikings copied the same things that these small African Twa people who became the first Vikings, they copied everything. So the Viking and Norse way of life is a stolen way of life from the African Twa people. So stay with me. The Vikings, the Anglo-Saxons, and what have you. Now, this is deep, because the Anglo-Saxons are kind of like the cousins. of the Vikings, in a way, the white Vikings, they were very unruly, okay? And so this is kind of interesting. It's a little bit of allegory, but it's like, you know, they're unruly cousins who just kind of kicked in the door one day and without even knocking, and they decided that they were going to live in a spare bedroom upstairs. And occasionally they come downstairs to beat you up and force you to make them food and then take your stuff up into their room. Okay, follow me. So then after that, you have the Normans. The Normans are worse. The Normans were a horrible bunch. They invaded, conquered, displaced, committed genocide and everything against the white Anglo-Saxons. We are talking about white-on-white crime right here, okay? So they also then invaded and conquered their neighbors. But the English are the ones who currently get the blame for everything, despite being their actual first victims. So as a result of the deaths of the original black Celtic inhabitants being killed, okay, after they all got killed off, these white Angles and Saxons assumed their identity as Celtics, or Celtics, as some people say in Boston. We're watching the Boston Celtics, but it's really Celt. That C-E-L-T is Celt. And so even when you get to the traditions of the Celtic knot and the clada, those things are not attributed by white people. They're actually done by black people from thousands of years ago. And these people lived in the British Isles, which we now call Great Britain, which is Ireland, Britain, and Scotland. Okay? So after they did all these people off and they get rid of the black folk, they started to get nervous and scared. And so in some instances, they became so afraid that the people who they murdered and massacred would literally come out of the grave and come to haunt them. These are the origins of Halloween. And so then you start to have different items that are associated with Halloween. So later on, you get the term jack-o'-lantern. Jack-o'-lantern means jack of the lanterns. Okay, this is a story that emerges around the 17th century in Britain. All right, by now, you have killed off most of the black population. Excuse me. So I don't know if Jack is white or black at this point, but in any event, the legend states that Jack would trick the devil and, you know, he did many different things because he was a maleficent individual to a certain extent. He wasn't very positive. Okay. Now, in Ireland, people started to carve out demonic faces out of turnips, not pumpkins, turnips, to frighten away Jack's wandering soul. All right. And the people became afraid, and they would do this to try to keep evil away. All right? So, of course, when the Irish immigrants moved to the U.S., they began carving jack-o'-lanterns from pumpkins, as pumpkins were more native to the region and bigger and easier to hold a piece of coal or a light in it. Anyway, here's a more in-depth version of the story. Stingy Jack. Stingy Jack was a miserable old drunken coot. He took great pleasure in playing tricks on just about everyone, family, friends, his mother, and even the devil himself. One day, he was at his favorite pub with the devil. The devil offered to buy Jack a drink in exchange for his soul. The devil transformed himself into a coin to pay for the drinks. But Jack stole the coin and put it in his pocket where he kept a cross. The cross kept the devil from changing back. Stingy Jack had freed the devil only after he agreed to wait for taking his soul. He's like, wait, don't take my soul yet. Years later, he ran into the devil by an apple tree. The devil wanted to take his soul right then and there. Stingy Jack bought some time by asking the devil to climb up the tree and get him an apple. As soon as the devil was in the tree, Stingy Jack trapped the devil, by placing crosses in a circle around the tree. Then Stingy Jack made the devil promise not to take his soul when he died. Many years later, Jack died and went to the pearly gates of heaven. He was told by St. Peter that he was mean and cruel and had led a miserable, worthless life on earth. Stingy Jack was not allowed to enter into heaven. Stingy Jack then went down to hell and the devil. The devil kept his promise and would not allow him to enter hell. So now Stingy Jack was scared. He had nowhere to go but to wander about forever in the dark netherworld between heaven and hell. He asked the devil how he could leave, as there was no light to see by. The devil tossed him an ember from the flames of hell to help Stingy Jack light his way. Jack had a turnip with him. It was one of his favorite foods, and he always carried one with him. So Jack hollowed out the turnip and placed the ember that the devil had given him inside of the turnip. From that day onward, Stingy Jack roamed the earth without a resting place, with only his dim turnip lighting the way. The Irish called the ghost of Stingy Jack, Jack of the Lantern, which was later abbreviated to Jack O'Lantern. On All Hallows Eve, the Irish hollowed out turnips, rutabagas, gourds, potatoes, and beets. They placed a light in them to ward off evil spirits and to keep Stingy Jack's spirit away. These were the original jack-o'-lanterns. In the 1800s, waves of Irish immigrants came to America. The Irish immigrants quickly discovered that pumpkins were bigger and easier to carve out, so they used pumpkins for the jack-o'-lanterns. Later on, during slavery, they would literally carve out a jack-o'-lantern, hollow out the bottom, and put the heads on deceased black people in the South who had been hung or who they just decided to kill. I'm going to say the last part one more time so you really understand what I'm trying to say. Later, during the time of enslavement of Native American and African peoples over here in America, they would carve out a pumpkin big enough to fit over the head of a person. Most of the time, it was a man that they had just hung or killed, and they put the pumpkin head on the dead man's head. Moving forward, because some people want to understand, you know, people dress up as all kinds of things. Me, I refuse. I cannot. I'm not dressing up as something that's dead. I'm not going to do that, all right? My husband and I had a gig this weekend, huge, huge event for Halloween, blah, 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 blah. And it was cute that the kids were having fun, and they had a haunted house, which we didn't go into, and all kinds of stuff. We just played music and ate and had a nice time. In any event, I saw people dressed up. You know, the Bride of Frankenstein, I saw dead people, I saw a couple of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Michael Myers, Jason, you know, a lot of undead, but a lot of vampires. I saw a lot of vampires, because it don't take much to put on a vampire costume, wear your cape, make your face white, put some blood around your mouth, and get those fake teeth, and boom, you got a costume. So anyway, I decided to go into do some research and find out who was the actual first vampire that we're really aware of. Wait for it. A man named Jure Grando Alilovic. Alilovic, or Jure Grando, from 1579 to 1656. He was a villager from the region of Istria, which is modern-day Croatia today. Okay, he might have been the first real person described as a vampire in historical records. He was referred to as a strigon, a local word for something resembling a vampire and a warlock. He was a stonemason, and his wife, Ivana, bore him two children, Anna and Nikola. I thought it's interesting that her name was Ivana, because that was Trump's first wife's name. Moving forward, Jure Grando lived in Kringa, a small town in the interior of the Istrian Peninsula near Tinjan. He died in 1656 due to illness, but according to legend, returned from the grave at night as a vampire, as Estrigón, and terrorized his village until he was actually decapitated in 1672. Between 1656 and 1672, that's a nice span of time for somebody to be wreaking havoc and what have you in the village. Nonetheless, Anna and Nicola, the daughter and son of Jure, fled from Istria to Volterra, Italy, at very young ages. Excuse me. So the word Strigon in Venetian, which is commonly spoken in Istria, means sorcerer. In Italian, it's Stregone. The legend tells that, excuse me, for 16 years after his death, Jure would arise from his grave by night and terrorize the village. The village priest named Giorgio, who had been buried by Jure 16 years previously, discovered that at night somebody would knock on the doors around the village, and on whichever door he knocked, somebody from that house would die within the next few days. Jure also appeared to his terrified widow, Ivana, in her bedroom. She described the corpse as looking as though he was smiling and gasping for breath, but then he would sexually assault her. Stay with me. When Father Giorgio eventually came face to face with the vampire, he held out a cross in front of him and yelled, "Behold Jesus Christ, you vampire, stop tormenting us." The bravest of the villagers, led by the prefect Miho Radetic, chased and tried to kill the vampire by piercing his heart with a hawthorn stick, but failed because the stick just bounced off of his chest. One night later, 9 people went into the graveyard carrying lamps, a cross, and a hawthorn stick. They dug up Jury's coffin and found a perfectly preserved corpse with a smile on his face. Father Giorgio said, "Look, Strigon, there is Jesus Christ, who saved us from hell and died for us. And you, Strigon, you cannot have peace." They then tried to pierce his heart, and again, the stick could not penetrate its flesh. After some exorcism prayers, Stepan Milasik, one of the villagers, took a saw and sawed the head off of the corpse. As soon as the saw tore its skin, the vampire screamed and blood started to flow from the cut. According to folklore, peace finally returned to the region after Jure's decapitation. Wow. See, I'm not dressing up with these things. I'm not doing that. I've never been a vampire. I've never been anything dead. I'm not inviting negative energy into my cycle. We are not doing that. In any event, I just thought it was interesting to bring these things up to you because we are, you know, most people, and even when I'm driving around my neighborhood, I see everybody's got a jack-o'-lantern on the front stoop. I mean, if anything, I'll just put out a regular plain pumpkin and let the deer eat it because we're going to eat it anyway. But I'm not carving out, you know, gruesome faces and things into pumpkins and gourds and leaving them on my doorstep to keep evil away from my house. We're not doing that. And I also want to ask you all, don't you think it's rather interesting how gruesome European folklore and history actually is? Vampires are also described as white men who would be butt naked under a black cloak, running into villages and snatching victims to bite them in the jugular and suck their blood. This is also a European story. It could have a little truth to it. And with all the vampire movies that we see, you got to be out your mind if you do not think that vampires actually exist. You do have people who drink human blood. Whether they suck it right out your neck or they have it in a cocktail glass, they do it. So this is one of those days. Halloween is one of those days when a lot of stuff gets to kind of happen under the radar because Halloween is happening. I'm not one who wants to get frightened for excitement and entertainment. No, I'm not. I'm not that girl. You can call me what you want to call me, but I'm not. I'm not doing it. Because my consciousness is too vast, and I am not trying to take images and different types of, you know, not just pictures, but yeah, images. I don't want to take these things into my unconscious and my subconscious. I'm not really trying to do that. So be careful with Halloween. Be careful. All right, I know everybody's running around, you know, tomorrow they're going to be trying to get candy, da, 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 da. They're going to dress the children up in school. They're going to give the candy out in school. They're going to do all of this other stuff. But stand that origin and where certain things come from. All right? I'm moving on. Excuse me. I just wanted to really share that with you and help you to glean a little bit more information, okay? Now, everybody is ranting and raving, and some people have their panties in a bunch, and I can definitely understand why. I'm not going to say that I couldn't understand why. But this recent situation in Israel-Palestine did not happen in a vacuum. All right, this has been an issue for a very long time, and it got worse in 1948 when the British began to cause their havoc and division in the region. I'll get back to that later. But in 1914, during the time of World War One, a lot of countries in the world thought that the war would be over in a matter of months. And when it wasn't, Britain's prime minister at the time actually sought to widen the conflict due to the stalemate of European countries, all right? So they then decided to mastermind a strategy to undermine different world powers. And this secret plan was used, subversion, division, misdealings, and deceit, all right? At the time, Turkey was looked at as the underbelly of nations in the Middle East. In 1915, there was a secret treaty between Britain and France to give Russia access to the Mediterranean Sea by way of Constantinople. This actually undercut other nations, including the U.S., because Britain and France had lied to them and to other allies, all right? So Russia then wanted to tempt Italy and bring them to the table so they too could be bribed by Britain and France. And all of this was being done to weaken the Ottoman Empire. Britain then created the term nationalism. We've heard that, haven't we? Okay. Britain coined that term, and they did it to employ further division amongst different Middle Eastern nations, including Turkey, okay, because you're dealing with Muslims predominantly, hello, in this region, and they knew that they were all sort of banding together as one people. So they said, no, we have to divide that. So if we create nationalism, then the Turks are going to be the Turks, and the Arabs in Arabia are going to be that. The Palestinians will be the Palestinians. You know, the Jordans will be the Jordanians. The Syrians will be the Syrians. The Lebanese will be the Lebanese. They'll all be separate. Okay, and this is why I even used to teach this when I taught history to my seventh grade students, that the divide and conquer tactic has been around for a very long time. And unfortunately, that shit is effective. Okay? So this caused great conflict between Turkey and other Arab nations. And the Turks then pushed to have a unified nation. But the Arabs didn't want to be a part of it. They're like, well, we're not Turkish. And so they went against the Ottoman Empire. Okay,
They wanted their own nation. So Britain and France started to seduce the Arabs to join the Europeans. They had put this friction between them and the Ottomans. They decided, okay, let's, you know, seduce them into joining the Europeans. Now, enter the Hejaz people of Arabia. They were under the ruling of Sharif Hussein, and he was responsible for Mecca, Medina, and the Arab Empire. Sharif Hussein was given authority because he was a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So you get Britain courting the Arab Empire, which is led by Sharif Hussein. Sharif Hussein's son became a commander-in-chief to try to help this plan go into action, but they too were deceived, all right? And even though there were treaties and agreements that were written, they were all broken. Sound familiar? In any event, as time goes by, Sharif's son assumes being governor of Syria. And this made the British go buck wild. They were so upset. Now, mind you, I need to rewind a bit and help you realize that the British had a headquarters in Cairo, Egypt, because the British were trying to take complete control of the entire Middle East. So, of course, you're going to have to lie and cheat and, you know, deceive the Arab people because your agenda is to take over their whole stuff anyway. So you're basically trying to do a little dance with Sharif Hussein and his family to get them to join you so that you will then take over that entire region. So let me fast forward a little bit. By the time you get into the 1940s, and, you know, you've got World War II popping off, and we all know, I'm not talking about the Japanese part of World War II, Punkin. I'm talking about the Hitler part of World War II. You have Jews in Europe fleeing for their lives because in Poland, in parts of the USSR, in France, Germany, Spain, England, war was rampant. World War II was not a game, a joke, or a drill. Nobody wants to see that again, but I'm just saying it was not a game. And so the control from Britain was a fierce stronghold. And remember, the United States didn't want any involvement in World War II, okay? It was not until the sinking of the SS Lusitania. It was a cruise ship, and supposedly they said that it had been bombed by the Germans and it had sunk. This was not a true story. This was propaganda. But this propaganda was used to bait America into joining World War II. Okay? Then you got Pearl Harbor and Japan because they were like, you weren't in the war in the first place. You didn't have any business joining the war, so we're going to get you anyway. And at that time, President Roosevelt was well aware that the Japanese were coming to bust our ass. He just let it go. And so Pearl Harbor happened. Nonetheless, across the pond, we've got the Zionist Bolsheviks gaining power. And this is a group, some were Jewish, some were not, but they were Zionist. And so they were only able to move into the region of Palestine. You notice how I'm not calling it Israel. They were able to move into the region through what was called the Balfour Declaration. And Balfour was a British politician to a certain extent who created this declaration, meaning that they declared, okay, that, excuse me, these people, these Zionists, would be allowed to go into Palestine and live there. Okay? This is deep because most of the time people want to start at 1948, but this is before 1948. Okay? This is before 1948. So, excuse me. Now you have droves and droves of white Jewish people flooding into Palestine. Why? Because they really didn't have anywhere else to go. America wasn't that welcoming. I mean, we're like, yeah, people can come here. But the exodus, if you will, was from Europe. We're trying to flee persecution and the Nazi movement. Okay? So stay with me. The Palestinians and other Muslims in surrounding countries like Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq were all tricked and deceived, like I said. They had no say about these people coming to inhabit Palestine. They had no say. And at that time, even if you look on a map from 1940, you will not see Israel as a location. You're going to see Palestine. All of what you've been seeing on the news that they say is Israel is actually Palestine. Stay with me. So, again, due to this persecution of Jews in Poland and Germany and so on and so forth, Mr. Balfour, had pitched this idea to the Zionists to make Palestine their new home. And so you begin to get an influx of white into Palestine. Are they welcome? Not really. Okay? The British had divided all of Arabia, including Palestine and Lebanon and Syria, what have you, into two groups, Group A and Group B. They put a line through the whole thing. The line went straight through Iran, Iraq, and Syria and what have you. And they decided that they would maintain control of the B part, and the A part would be just for the Arabs. But the Arabs were like, we have already been here for thousands of years. Why are you drawing a line through our country and stating that this is now where only we can be? So it didn't go very well, nonetheless. And, excuse me, they're under the Hejaz control through Sharif Hussein and his son, all hell was fitting to break loose. Because, again, you're tricking them and you're making them believe that everything is fine when it's really not fine. You're taking over their country. You're taking over their land. And so as you begin to get this influx of white Jewish people, men, women, and children, into this region, okay, Britain helps them to build houses and just take over Palestinian land. Now, the Palestinians did not resort to war at that time. They did not, not in Palestine, okay? They were definitely having some war in Syria. But in Palestine, they were trying to be amicable and let these people come and live there if they could just, you know, be good law-abiding citizens. And even though we were of different faiths, they always were respectful to other religions. And so that's why you always had Christians, Muslims, and Jews in Palestine living relatively harmoniously. Okay, so as we go forward and we're dealing with this Balfour Declaration, the Zionists, especially from Germany, were definitely pushing having a Jewish state. Now, I've spoken about this before because Jewish people, according to rabbinic law, rabbinic story and rabbinic law, are not allowed to be a state yet. They're not allowed to be a state until the Messiah has returned. And so according to them, especially Sephardic Jews, Sephardic and Hasidic, excuse me, they do not believe that the Messiah has come. And so they are waiting in a state of exile to wander the earth until the Messiah returns. So this Zionist movement pushes that to the side, and that's how you get this quote-unquote like state of Israel. It is not governed by Judaic law at all. It is not governed by this. So as this influx of white European Jews comes into Palestine, they then begin to destabilize the population. Okay, you had millions of Palestinians, and then maybe you had like a few thousand Jewish people. But over time, the graph starts to switch, and you get more and more and more white Jewish Europeans than you would have naturalized Palestinians. Now, also at this time, Palestine is now no longer considered to be its own country. There is no nationalism of Palestine except for the people themselves. But as far as government concerned, they don't have one because they have been completely usurped by the white European Jew. So it's really just a matter of time. By the time we get to 1948, you have a panel of white European men who are predominantly Zionists. They don't wear yarmulkes. They don't dress as the traditional Orthodox Jewish man. They are Zionists in name only. They're not necessarily Jewish. And so they are the ones who create the official state of Israel through the United Nations, the cooperation of Britain and other European countries. So basically, we're talking about a hijack. We're talking about theft yet again. Now, if you rewind a little bit to what I was talking about in the beginning of the show with regard to Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and Normans, and whoever, that invade other areas and take over by brute force, by killing everybody, raping people, the whole nine. This is what they do. This is what happens when these people evidently set their sights on a specific location and place and decide to infiltrate, invade, and take over. And so what we're experiencing now are the chickens coming home to roost. This was only a matter of time because, excuse me, over all these years from 1948, more and more and more and more and more and more white European people have moved into Palestine to the point where they've taken total control of it, to the point where Israel becomes a nation state where they can have their own government, they have a president, they have a prime minister, la, 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 la. And they then set the rules on what a Palestinian can do, where a Palestinian can go, where a Palestinian can live, etc. They then push the Palestinian population into what is known as the Gaza Strip. They put sanctions and holds on the Palestinian people in their own country, similar to what happened to the Native American here. That, too, was done by the British predominantly. Yes, you had France and Spain, but in each situation, the Spanish and the French were beaten by the British with the help of inhabitants of America. So we are watching in real time now a group of individuals and people, a people who are tired. Israel controls the power, the water, access to food, medication, different types of services. You had several hospitals in Gaza. Now I think only we have one because of what has been happening with the bombing from Israel. And although when I watch the news, I'm trying not to get an attitude because I'm hearing that everybody, you know, a lot of people are pro-Israel. And I had written in a comment, you got to follow the money because we all should know who owns the media. Our media is owned by Jews. I'm going to say it again. Our media is controlled by Jews. Even our social media, except for TikTok, because TikTok is owned by a Chinese man. Facebook, Instagram is Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg is Jewish. I don't know if Elon Musk has a religion or not. I'm not sure. I didn't look that up yet. But I'm just saying, our mainstream media networks, ABC, Fox, MSNBC, most of these outlets, even CBS, honey, owned by Jewish people. So they're going to control a narrative, and they're going to control the pundits and the anchor people that they have on these news networks to say, or I should say not say, what they don't want them to say. So when you hear, certain newscasters talk about how horrible Hamas is and blah, 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 you also got to go back and do your history because Hamas was actually created by Israel. Hamas was created by Israel to watch over and look over the Palestinian people. And I guess as time went by, they got tired. Now, I'm not condoning violence in any way, but I understand the violence that has been done to the Palestinian people since and before 1948. So we're just supposed to agree with the Israelis? We're supposed to be pro-Israel? No, no, there's a problem with that. These people have wreaked havoc in this region. Like I said, if you're listening to me right now, go back and Google the map in 1940. That whole region is called Palestine and is not called Israel. So the fact that we've all been goaded into saying it's Israel, we're believing it's Israel, it's Israel, it's Israel. No, it's only Israel because of the people that are there. And it's Israel because these other European governments supported the state of Israel, even though it's not supposed to be a state. I truly believe that had they not deemed Israel to be a state, had they not gone so out of their way to market this region to white European Jewish people, of course, fleeing persecution and Nazism and what have you. If they did not do that and they just allowed people to come or whatever, not to take over to a Palestinian person, they're going to tell you that the Israeli people are settlers because they settled there, packed a bag, packed up some stuff, came over, and did not leave. So this is a modern thing that we're seeing. This is a modern pattern. What I talked about before with, you know, the vampires and jack-o'-lanterns and all that stuff, and the invasion of Britain by white people that got rid of most of the black population, aside from some people who did, you know, manage to linger in Ireland and Scotland. you know, ultimately speaking, Oh, thank you. Thanks, Mama. She said Elon Musk is agnostic. Okay, he's special, though. But with these people coming, with everyone coming, staying, okay? Now, I remember when I was in Israel when I was a young girl. I was maybe about, I want to say 15 or so. But I remember being there. I remember the feeling. I remember seeing the Palestinians. I remember seeing black Jews. I remember seeing a lot of black Jews, actually. There are less black Jews there now than ever before. Why? Because the white Jewish people look down on them. They call them niggers. They call them names. They throw rocks at them. They're horrible to them. And these people, the black Jews, been there thousands of years as well, living harmoniously with amongst the Palestinian people. Originally, they were only supposed to get the areas, I believe, of Bethlehem and another, like, biblical city, and, of course, they would have access to the temple wall where the Temple Mount is. But again, even at the Temple Mount, you have the representation of the three major religions. You've got Islam, Christianity, and Judaism in one place. I remember being at Dome of the Rock. We couldn't go inside because we were women, but my father got to go inside. We just took pictures outside. But honestly speaking, everyone lived harmoniously in this region for a very long time, for thousands of years before this occupation. So when this occupation occurs, all hell is fitting to break loose because now you're displacing Palestinian people. So what happened on October 7th was retaliation against the occupation. Again, I am not condoning violence, but I even said this in a post. Hamas launched their attack in trifecta fashion on October 7th, but then they kind of yielded, at which point Israel then began to bomb the living hell out of Palestine, flattening hospitals, apartment buildings, schools, killing women and children and just elderly people, and everybody is just jacked up in the game. They have done so much damage to Gaza that how can the Palestinian people either stay or even return? And one of the reasons why Egypt and Jordan specifically are saying that we do not want to accept the Palestinian refugees is because they know that if the Palestinians leave Gaza and leave Israel, they probably won't be allowed to come back. They will lose whatever piece of land they have. Israel will literally knock that wall down and just bulldoze all of that shit into the Mediterranean Ocean, and that'll be that. So when people are pro-Palestine, or when people understand the position that Palestine has taken, that the Palestinian people have taken with regards to this occupation, it doesn't make those people anti-Semitic. I get very, very tired when I hear white people and newscasters and what have you say that if somebody has an issue with somebody who's Jewish, it's anti-Semitic. No, it's not. It just means I got an issue with your ass. Again, especially those of us who are melanin dominant, we can't be anti-Semitic. Why? The Semites are the children of Shem, Noah's son Shem. You had Shem, Ham, and Yapheth. Shem is what Semite comes from. Noah was black. Shem black too. Hello? I can't not be what I am. As melanin dominant people, we're the brown part of the Semites. We're brown people. Reddish brown, brown people. So now this gets co-opted onto a white Ashkenazi Jew. But just because it gets co-opted onto them, does it really mean it's so? And if you listen to a real Orthodox rabbi, he's going to condemn Zionism. He's going to condemn this occupation. Like, listen to the real rabbis, not the Zionists, because the Zionists have a whole nother agenda, which is so funky, it's insane. And y'all know I do like to cite the words from the book, The Protocols of Zion, Hello Good Morning. And within that book, they got it in PDF form now. You can Google it. But within that book, I got the hard copy, baby. Within that book, they talk about how anybody who is not Jewish is basically an animal. They're not worth saving, which is what you hear when you hear Israeli people talk about Palestinian people. How are you going to talk shit about somebody whose land you stole? Same thing with the Native American here. Same thing with the Aborigines in Australia. So we're living and broiling in this pot of propaganda, but so much of it is just straight BS. It's not funny. They've poised themselves as being this pious group of individuals that wouldn't hurt a flea. Meanwhile, the Israeli army has killed more Palestinian people, men, women, and children, since they've been there. Once they got the numbers up that they really wanted, they then began, by threat of gunfire and what have you, ushering Palestinian people out of their own homes. Homes that have been there for a very, very long time. And now, at gunpoint, you're being forced out of your house. Just like they said the other day, that they could go into the desert. Really? The desert? They want to force themselves into the desert. It's inhabitable. Hello? Not easy to survive in the desert. But they don't care. I heard Benjamin Netanyahu the other day say something absolutely horrible, talking about we are the people of the light and they are the people of the dark. No, you're not. Sorry, BB. You are not. I can't stand when people just act like they say something and so it is, just because they said it. No. No. And, again, I continue to stress that this Ashkenazi Jew was a creation after a crazy satanic king went over into the Palestinian area, hello, received Judaic studies and Judaic law, and took it back. Okay, took it back into Europe. And then decided to convert the people into Judaism. But they continued their satanic ways as well. And this is why you have the synagogue of Satan. And I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes. You know, I always talk about knowledge is power. You got to do the research. You got to turn the damn TV off sometimes, cut the Netflix off, stop watching the NFL, and pay attention. Do some reading. Buy some books. Because what we're watching is retaliation. We're not watching an attack that just comes out of the blue because Hamas is wild and crazy and has no care for life. No, not really. That's not what we're seeing. What we are seeing are a group of people who are tired of losing. A group of people who have not had any international support, especially European support, at all. Why? Because they're brown people. Britain had so much dominance in the area, and they wanted to take over the entire area. all of Palestine, all of Arabia, all of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. They want to take over all of it. And I find it so interesting that Britain, such a small place in actuality, they're a small place with big balls. Look what they did here. The United States of America is but a satellite of England. The United States of America, with George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, all of them came from England. But what we are watching is, it is horrible. And I do wish peace in that region. I've always wished for peace in that region. I've prayed for peace in that region when I was in the damn region myself. But what we're seeing, you can't have peace. How can you have peace with a liar? How can you have peace with individuals who have taken over your whole country, just like Native Americans here? And, you know, we're some loving people. We're loving, we're forgiving. You got Native Americans living like shit right now on different reservations. Does this nation care? Of course not. They're the ones that put them there in the first place. You have tens of thousands of Native American tribes, but yet only five are recognized by the United States government? What? So what we're seeing over there is retaliation. And then on top of that, since October 7th, the Israeli government has been bombing the living daylights out of Gaza. The only news network that I have seen that even gives you a piece of truth and a piece of empathy for the Palestinian people is MSNBC. They got Muslims in their ranks, so they're going to tell the truth. That is what we are watching. And so for this nation to be so pro-Israel, that's a message to you black folk. You know it was the Jews who paid the money to build the slave ships, right? You do know that you had Jewish plantation owners all throughout the South and up the Mississippi River. I really hope you know that. Do not think that they did not have a hand in the enslavement of Native American and African peoples. They had a big hand, and they had a lot of money. And we're also talking about a group of people who were given a pass by the Muslims who were the Moors in Spain and the Iberian Peninsula for over 700 years. The Jews were in charge of money and the jewelry. That's why jewelry is called jewelry. But yet, these same people turn around, jump on the enslavement bandwagon, help to build ships, and help to ruin the lives of millions of melanin dominant people. They were all up and in and through the slave trade. It does get under my skin, when I see melanin dominant people talking about I stand with Israel. And some of them are just ignorant because they just stand with Israel because they're Christian. I'm like, wasn't it the Jews that killed Jesus in the first place? But hello? And I'm not anti-Jewish at all. I know the original Jews are black people. I know that once this particular occupation began, you had thousands of melanin-dominant Jewish people who fled back into Africa. There's a huge population, the Lumba people, in Ghana. Lemba, maybe it's Lemba, but there's a huge population of African Jewish people all throughout Africa. You got black Jews all over the world. The late, great Dr. Ben Yohanan, or Yohanan, however you want to say it, he was an Ethiopian Jew. And do you remember the time when Israel supposedly opened up their arms to Ethiopian Jews, but that was for what, 2 minutes? They shut that down real quick because they did not want black Jewish people to populate in Israel. Then we go a little bit further, and this is how you know it's a Zionist movement and it's not necessarily a Jewish or a Judaic movement. Present-day Israel started to welcome the LGBTQIA alphabet people to move or vacation in Israel. Now, isn't homosexuality supposed to be against Torah law? It's in there. In Deuteronomy, I believe. But see, the Zionist movement is closer to the Babylonian version of Judaism, and that is a very nasty version. That's where you get your synagogue of Satan from. Because the original quote-unquote Jewish person wasn't even called a Jew. So I'm going to get into that in a second. And I hope I get through what I'm trying to say. Because we are in beam-up time. We are in a time where we've got to raise frequency. The only way you raise frequency is through love and goodness and kindness. That is the only way to raise your frequency. Frequencies of fear, frequencies of dislike, frequencies of hate, frequencies of oppression are very low vibrations. They're low frequency. But love and being good and being kind are the highest frequencies that we can attain. So that's what we're supposed to be doing. And I've talked about this before, but I'm going to reiterate it tonight on the eve of All Hallows Eve, because I have come to the conclusion that the true key to life is really about being good. And I'm not trying to sound like a wuss. Okay? But I know that because we are eternal entities, we are eternal beings, because our soul is immortal, that we will return to this world. We're going to come back to this earth. So wouldn't it be nice to try to leave it as nicely as you can so when you come back, you come into something that's pretty nice? I always say I felt like I must have been fantastic in my former life, because this lifetime, I was born into glory. I was born into love. I was born into two parents who were best friends. My mother was a virgin. I was born into love and hugs and kisses every day, and seeing my father tongue kiss my mother when he came home from work and squeeze her booty and give her hugs and kisses all the time. That's what I grew up in. Have I ever really found that? No. I realized that vibration of love that they had for each other, that my household that I grew up in was so much harmony, so much bounty, fortune. I mean, it was a dream. And now that I'm this age, I can definitely go back and reflect and see how amazing it was to live that way, how amazing it was to be loved on all the time. How amazing it was to see a black man and a black woman love and cherish each other till death. I am still striving for that level of perfection. I am still longing for that life because I had it and I know what it is. And you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So as much love as I have for everybody in my life, I don't receive what I used to receive. So, yeah, when I lost my mom, yeah, I lost my best friend. Because she was so overflowing with love. We never hung up the phone without saying, I love you. We never left the house without saying, I'm going to such and such. I love you. I love you too. We never, I mean, never. We could have had an argument. And we still say, I love you. I love you. So I know that my past life had to be vainglorious in order for me to be born into that. I know it was. Because I didn't come into my life with a silver spoon. I was born with a gold spoon. So I know what real love is. I know it. That's why I am so mushy and I am sensitive. Because I know that love is what moves mountains. My parents were two little black kids, first generation born in America from Caribbean and Spanish Dominican parents, and still hit the ground running, got degrees, had beautiful jobs. We always had two cars. We always had a huge house. We had a yacht. We traveled the world. And I know it wasn't because of just fortune and circumstance or opportunity. It was because of the love that they just exhumed everywhere. They just, love was everywhere. They would help anybody, everybody. I never saw my father be mean to anybody, but I never saw him be mean. Never. So when you're raised in that and then you come into this world and you got to deal with whatever's going on in this world after you are grown up and you leave that household and what have you, and you're trying to hold all this love, you're trying to hold all this power, and you just get slapped around because other people don't value love as much as you do, it can be really rough. I'm surprised I have made it this far, honestly. Because I'm coming from sunshine and roses and smiles, and I know that a lot of people haven't had that life. I know people didn't have the crystal stair, you know, life. I know that. But because I did, I really do my best to continue to emit love and to pray for the world and to pray for my family and to pray for my friends and love everybody, even strangers that I meet. I am kind and I am respectful. I'm giving you a smile. You might not have seen a damn smile all day. You're going to see one when you see me at the cash register. I'm going to ask you, how was your day? You're a total stranger to me. But then again, to me, you're kind of not. Because we're all together on this planet. So my legacy is always going to be love. I do my best. And although I still get smacked around, not physically, but emotionally, I'm still trying to hold my ground. But there's nothing in the world like when you come into so love and abundance, and then you go into the world, and it's a mess. And the people that you try to love are a mess. The people that you try to love are banged up and hurt and emotionally, quote unquote, retarded because they didn't get that. But you still love them anyway. So, it is very important for us to be good. It is very important for us to be loving and kind. It is important for us to have an optimistic mindset, not a pessimistic mindset, because if you're pessimistic, then all you're going to get is lack. When you're optimistic, it's infinite. Your bounty can be infinite. All types of wonderful things will just come your way by way of magnetism. Because we're magnetic entities. We're electromagnetic entities. So whatever you really, really desire in your heart, especially when you know it's something that's good, it's good for you and it's good for others, you can receive that. It is very difficult to receive blessings and miracles when you are in a state or you maintain a vibration that's low, fighting against the tide. But if you're in a state of abundance and love, poof, it happens. It happens like poof. This is why it's important for couples to try and magnify positive vibrations in their home, in their individuated selves. It's important. When I meditate and I pray, I'm so grateful and thankful. I know that what I desire is not far-fetched because I've already had it. My parents gave me the perfect example of how to be a beautiful human. And I'm going to be that until I die. The way things are going, and because you have certain people who control certain things, they want all of us to suffer. They want us to live in lack. They want us to hurt ourselves and each other. They want us to be these animals that they try to say we are. So you got to do your thing to fight that. Again, we are always going to return to this place because we are in a perpetual state of evolution. And the only way your behind does not come back is if you've actually achieved a level of a Christ-like consciousness. It's so heightened that we would not need a physical body anymore. We are nowhere near there. Even with my wonderful lifestyle, upbringing, all of that, I know I'm coming back. I still have work to do. I'm striving to the best of my ability to maintain a very heightened vibration. But I know I'm coming back. And so are you. So it would behoove us to get our shit together and to raise our vibrations in love and light. It would behoove us to do so. Because then you can come back. When you do come back, you won't come back into a hellish type of life. We are talking about the highest levels of consciousness. So none of us are there. You know, please, please. I beg you, because I know tomorrow's Halloween and I know people are going to die. But honestly speaking, you got to understand, and overstand that we are supposed to be loving and kind and compassionate, gentle and benevolent beings. We are not supposed to be malevolent. We are not supposed to be evil and wicked and selfish and bitter and tired and argumentative. We're not meant to be that. So we have been sold a real bad story. And there are fake philosophies about us, oh, only living one time, and, you know, and that we're not eternal. We are eternal. Get a hold of it. There are way too many ancient theologies and ancient texts, ancient shamans, Dalai Lamas, okay, the Buddhists, and I mean the Buddhists that live in Tibet and don't speak. There have been Christos. Jesus Christ supposedly was not the last Christos. They only stole that name to give him a bigger title. Again, I tell you, the person didn't exist. Yeshua existed, but Jesus Christ did not. I'll get into that. So everybody's so hooked up on Jesus, and I'm like, careful. Because, yeah, you could tell a lie long enough, they're going to believe it. And again, I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes or hurt anyone's philosophy, but I know. I've learned. I've read. I've studied. You know, we got stuff written all over the walls in ancient Kemet. You know, you got other African cultures that know how sacred life is and how we're supposed to live. So you got to excuse me, because although many of you or your families may be Christians, Muslims, or even Jewish or whatever, but all of these philosophies are fragmented versions of ancient African ways of life, each one of them, each one, you know? I was even mentioning to my husband and my son that the ancient Kemites used to bathe 5 times a day. You want to talk about a people who had to maintain a level of purity? They wanted to maintain the highest levels of spiritual purity. Therefore, they bathed 5 times a day. They bathed to purify every element is why they bathed 5 times a day. Yes, I said ether, because ether's everywhere. They possess more knowledge than we know today. So scholars like myself and many others are still trying to learn this knowledge and get it down pat, because it's beyond deep. If you take a minute and read the Emerald Tablets, you'll blow your own mind. If you read the Enuma Elish, you will blow your own mind. And you've got to realize that this bathing 5 times a day in Kemet becomes praying 5 times a day in Islam. Are you following me? Because there was no water in the desert. So they said, well, if we pray 5 times a day, then we can remain pure for the Creator. Now, I know y'all might get tight, but stay with me. Because the Roman concept of Christianity is an invention of the Judeo-Claudian dynasty, circa 60 AD. It's an amalgamation of Hebraic law, paganism, and Satanism. Stay with me. Yes, a lot of y'all may not like hearing this, but it's true. I may have to do this for another show as well, because I know the whole world ain't on here right now, but I know a lot of my listeners are paying close attention. They took the Hebraic writings and they put them together with a chronicle of the lives of Titus and Vespasian Flavian. They were the rulers of the Flavian dynasty. So if you were to read the story of the Jewish wars by Josephus, and then you read the King James Bible at the same time, you might throw up because the similarities are uncanny. Why? Because the Flavians captured Josephus during the siege of Jerusalem. The last siege of Jerusalem was fierce. And however, they eventually returned to sack and destroy Jerusalem. When they did that, they stole the Torah, the golden menorah, and all other Hebraic scholarly writings. So Josephus was a scholar as well as a rebel fighter for the Messianic order. Upon his capture, he was fighting for his life, and so he decided to say that he was a prophet. He was like, you can't kill me, I'm a prophet. So, of course, they asked him to prophesy something, to which he said that Vespasian Flavian will become Caesar. Nero was Caesar at the time, but Nero had a lot of issues. And so when things weren't going well, he decided to commit suicide and just end it all. At which point, Vespasian Flavian became Caesar. So when he did become Caesar, they were definitely convinced. Okay, so then they ordered him to rewrite the Hebraic text to fit their narrative. So basically, yes, yeah, somebody wrote a story that we call the Bible, but they basically made a lot of it up just to save their ass. Basically, they divided up the many sections and different powerful families also rewrote the entire book. Families like the Medicis, the Herods, these are wealthy families. So, of course, these are people who don't want to be controlled, so they're going to write things to help control other people. You also had a high level of illiteracy in Rome, so they couldn't read. So you can put together this big, big book. They're just going to look at it and take your word for it because they can't read anyway. Okay? Ever think about why they said that slaves couldn't read? Because when you read, you get knowledge. When you get knowledge, you start thinking. start thinking, and you're going to upset the cart. Ain't nothing new under the sun, boo. So, they rewrote Biblos. And a lot of the writings that they had gotten from Judea were written in Greek. So they translated everything into Latin. And it was a very sinister plan, and it worked. The world was fooled by fables and lore in the name of God. So if we take a little journey and we look into the Flavian dynasty in Rome and why they created Jesus Christ, stay with me real quick. From 49 BCE to 69 AD, during a time of political conflict, a failing economy, and impending war, the Julio-Claudian dynasty ruled Rome. They are responsible for changing Rome from a republic to an empire. You had Julius Caesar in 49 BCE. You had Augustus in 27 CE, which is supposedly the time of Jesus' birth. You have Tiberius in 14 CE, which is supposedly around the time of Jesus' death. You had Caligula. Y'all remember Caligula? That was 37 CE. Claudius in 41 CE. And then Nero in 54 CE. The last reign of the Julio-Claudian dynasty was the Flavians. And the Flavians were a military family led by the father, Vespasian Flavian, and his son Titus. The original Hebraic family of Judea, Palestine at that time, were inhabited by the Maccabeans, which was a North African family. But the Herods, which were Greco-Arab, conquered them and took control of Palestine. Judaic stories of the Messiahs were about warriors. The Messianic movement created several Christs within the Palestinian community. This is a time, again, we're talking about North African black people. When this movement set up shop directly in the middle of the Roman Empire, this was a problem. So during the reign of Nero, he used Vespasian and Titus Flavian to fight for him. Flavians were a military family. They were soldiers. So for over a decade, they had ruined the Druidian Empire of Britanny. And the Romans under Nero felt that the Messianic Empire was getting too powerful and that they had to be conquered. So in 66 CE, the Flavians began their military assault on the Hebrews in Judea and, with 60 to 70,000 troops, entered the northern area of Galilee and destroyed it. Then, as I said before, they captured the rebel, who was one of the leaders of the rebellion, whose name was Josephus Bar Matthias. Josephus Bar Matthias becomes Joseph Arimathias of the Bible. All right? So as I said, they were going to kill him, but he posed as a prophet, blah, 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 blah. And he was able to save his life by being a translator. Vespasian's entourage, and to appeal to the rebels to surrender. Okay? So, of course, Josephus was seen as a turncoat with the rebels in the Messianic order he once led. And he worked with the Flavians against his own people to save his own behind. Okay? So, when they came back and Vespasian becomes Caesar, blah, 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 they then give him the name Flavius Josephus. They give him an apartment in the Flavian Palace, and now he's beginning to write the history of the war. While Josephus and Titus were in Judea, again, Nero's rule had come to an end, okay? The Roman Senate had stripped him of the title of Caesar because things were going so wrong. So as I said before, he committed suicide, and that is how Vespasian becomes the emperor okay? But and the Roman army made him Caesar. There wasn't even like a vote about anything. The Roman army said, okay, you're Caesar now. So it was actually a coup because he might not have been next in line to become Caesar. So at this time, the Flavians are gaining full control of Rome. They have full control of Rome in 69 CE. Titus stays behind in Jerusalem, crushes the entire Judaic city. He encircles the city with a wall, which also brings about starvation. By 70 CE, the temples in the city were completely destroyed, and Titus takes the spoils of war back to Rome, as I said. They took all of the Torahs, they took all of the menorahs, they took everything, okay? But they also took one of the Torahs for their own, and they had every other copy destroyed. Josephus then becomes the sole writer on the war. Okay, again, you've got to read the wars, the Jewish wars. You have to read that and put that with the Bible, and you'll see these concurrent running themes, okay? Now, the Romans then sought to change the messianic faith, and they recreated it to suit themselves. They then created rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. Then they make Vespasian Caesar into a god, and his son becomes the son of God, as in Jesus. The Flavians had to be seen as the Christ. The Roman imperial cult was a system which could actually establish a person as a god. So when Titus requested that his father Vespasian be deified and become a god, the Roman imperial cult approved this. This is the concept of God the Father and the Son of God. Completely made up. This became the basis for the Roman Catholic Church. Josephus became the great propagandist of Roman Christianity. The pagan rituals became infused into Christianity. The pagan aristocracy became priests of Rome. Many Roman churches have statues of Jesus, and below, right under another level, there's a statue of Mithras. Mithras is a Roman god. The funding and help to pull all of this off came from, as I said before, the ruling and wealthiest families in the world at the time. They themselves, as I said, were afraid of losing their status of wealth. So you had the Jewish family of the Alexanders. They were the wealthiest. Then you get a man named Filio of Alexandria. He was a famous Jewish theologian who combined Judaic writing with Greco-Roman paganism. Much of this became the basis for the creation of Christianity. He was very connected to the Flavians. You had Princess Berenice, who was from the Herod dynasty, a conquered messianic dynasty. They also had influence on the conspiracy to write the New Testament. She was married three times, once to an Alexander, and before she became the mistress of Titus. The Alexanders, the Herods, the Flavians, they all set forth to plan to construct and disseminate a New Testament of the Gospels. The writings of Josephus and these wealthy families become the Gospels of Jesus. They become the New Testament. But when you're dealing with the Gospels of Jesus, you are dealing with an individual who never actually existed. They then disseminated the writings all throughout Rome into Judea, all right? Hence the title, the Gospels according to Mark, Luke, Matthew, John. The word gospel actually means evangelia in Greek, and it means good news of military victory. Did y'all know that? That's what gospel means, good news of military victory, not just good news. Y'all Christians better get it together. Messiah is a Greek word, which means Christos, or Christ, and Jesus means Savior. So So the Romans also promoted anti-Semitism. They originally practiced Judaism, but they had Roman values and sided with Rome in the end. Okay? This is why Jews are looked at as the enemy. Okay? So the Jesus decades are from 1 CE to 33 CE, and the Flavians come into power in 69 CE to 96 CE. Jesus' ministry begins in 30 CE, exactly 4 years from the destruction of the temple, and his ministry ends at Passover, 33 CE, which is 4 years before the end of the Jewish-Roman War in 73 CE, which was at Passover with the famous Battle of Masada. The actual destruction of the temple was in 70 CE during the Flavian period. And if you go looking for historical evidence of the era, Pontius Pilate, the era of Pontius Pilate, you probably won't find anything. So basically the Gospels are backdated by 40 years in order to put the Flavians into the period of Pontius Pilate and their enemies, the Julio-Claudians. So by doing this, the prophecies of Jesus actually come true within exactly 40 years. So when you're worshiping Jesus, you're actually worshiping Caesar in disguise. There has never been any archaeological evidence of a Jesus as a human being ever existing. None. The Romans created Jesus. In pagan and other societies, you have sun worship. And this starts with Aten in Kemet, Apollo in Greece, Krishna in India, and Jesus in Rome. December 25th is the birth of the sun, S-U-N, because the sun dies on the Southern Cross in the sky and rises on the third day, which is December 25th. This is why they put the birth of Jesus on December 25th. Also, the process of resurrection is about the death of one's lower self and becoming more enlightened, as well as the rebirth cycle of the soul. Very little is original about Jesus. It's an amalgamation of Judaic law, paganism, Satanism, and some truisms. And when Jesus, the coming of the Son of Man, this is a direct reference to Titus Flavian. The early saints are also known as Christian Flavians. These are not saints like we think of them. They are members of the Flavian dynasty. Okay, first was Domitilla, who was the niece or sister to Titus, who donated the land for the establishment of the Roman Christian catacombs. She had a son named Clement. He was the first Roman Catholic pope after the Apostle Simon. And there were two members of the Flavian household staff, Nerus and Aquilas, who have churches named after them. The Christian theologian Titus Flavius Clement of Alexandria, he originally described the first Christian symbols. These were the anchor, the boat, the fish, the olive branch, and the star. These were the same symbols found on their coins. In the 4th century, Flavius Constantine made Christianity the official religion of Rome. Also, the Bible, as I said before, was written in Greek, not Hebrew. The original Torah and Old Testament was written in Hebrew, but they used typology, and typology is a prophetic way of writing. It describes future events. So the Romans used this when creating the gospel. This is why the Old Testament parallels with the book of Matthew, and then Jesus' stories parallel the actual stories of Titus Flavius. Many parables are identical, from fishes of men to the legion of demons at Gadara and Titus's battle at Gadara with the demons on the man which Jesus casts out. They turn into swine that run into the sea and drown. It's actually the Jewish rebels which are chased into the sea, and they are drowned. And in the Gospels, they are pigs. The crucified one who survived, Josephus, when with Titus comes across three of his friends being crucified, and he begs Titus for their release. Titus lets them down, but two die and one survives. So in the gospel, Joseph of Arimathea sees Jesus on the cross and asks a Roman commander to let Jesus down while Jesus is on the cross with three other people. I mean, two other people, so there's three altogether. You got to see these correlations. Text, context, and subtext are all at play in the reading of the Gospels. There are over 40 technological parallels between the Gospels and the works of Josephus. These chronicles follow the exact acts of Titus Flavian. These parallels are the Flavian signature of the Gospels. It follows subject by subject. Even with the Last Supper, Josephus takes a story from the fall of Jerusalem where a woman named Mary, who called her son a myth for the world, takes her son, slays him, ate him, thus turning him into a human Passover lamb. Then in the Gospels, we get the Last Supper where Jesus says, "This is my body, my blood. Take this in remembrance of me." It's all over these texts. The complete works of Flavius Josephus is another book that you can buy. Okay? So, you got the anti-Semitic Romans taking over rabbinic messianic law, changing everything around. This is in 60-something AD, okay? It's a long time ago. And then things just become more and more of a mess. We've been lied to for a long time, and it always has to do with someone's power. It always has to do with someone subduing other people, having control over people. Do yourself a favor and read the Protocols of Zion. Please read the Protocols of Zion. Then you'll get a real glimpse as to the Zionist movement at play right now in our world. One of the main things I always take away from the Protocols of Zion is the part when they say, "We will take over the world through brute force," and I believe fantasy, he said, make-believe, brute force and make-believe. So open your eyes, put your head on a swivel, do some reading, and look around. Because we truly need to bring supreme balance back to this planet and come away from certain myths which really don't serve us. Christianity and rabbinic Judaism were created and invented by the Romans to pacify and control their subjects, to get rid of the messianic black African order, and to control people. That's it. And it still exists. Dogma is dangerous, family. Dogma is dangerous. So, yeah, pray for Palestine. Pray for Israel. Pray for peace on this planet. Raise your frequency. Try to be as loving and kind and gentle as you possibly can. Because what we're going through and what's happening is not about to get better. My grandmother always used to say, "It's darkest before the dawn." So let's get light, raise our frequencies, let's be loving and kind to each other, okay? Because that love can heal this planet, and it can heal us as individuals. It can heal us. Peace, Sister Dawn. I see you, love. I see you. Thank you so much for being with me tonight, love. Thanks to everybody who was with me tonight. I appreciate all of you. I know I had a lot to say and a lot to unpack, but again, tomorrow is Halloween and a lot of mayhem is going to happen. You know, it's time for us to wake up. It's time for us to come out from under the spells. It's time. So you be good. You be love and light. Take care of each other. Another way to raise your frequency is always to listen to some really beautiful music. Look, check out DJ Pitch Control on SoundCloud.com, PYTCHCONTROLL. Get your life. Love some music. Okay, raise your frequencies, family. Thank you for being with me. Have a blessed week. One love. Mm-hmm.